The Monday Morning Tech Chat Show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is, of course, the premier audiobook service, perfect for folks who want their books read to them. Thousands and thousands of titles to choose from in all genres, sci-fi, fantasy, biographies, history, thrillers, mysteries, and more. We've got a great offer for listeners on this podcast, 2 free audiobooks when you sign up. And those books are yours to keep even if you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, which is $14.95 a month and gives you a free book every month of your choosing, as well as some other fun perks. Membership has its privileges. Hit up bit.ly/geekbookclub to start your free trial and get those 2 free books on lock. Once again, bit.ly/geekbookclub. And now, let's get into the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, your host, also known as Some Gadget Guy, which is the SGG of this terribly named, horribly named podcast series. And the QA, of course, stands for question and answer. So we like to keep these interactive conversations. We like to follow up on the top tech news stories, the top stories facing our industry, our enthusiast hobby, whatever brings you to the world of tech. We want to dig a little bit deeper. It's also why I like to host my show on a Monday. Gives us the week to kind of sort out how we feel about certain stories. Maybe some news broke over the weekend and we can follow up on that. And then we can really dig in and have that conversation. We like to be prepared so that we can be good resources for our family and friends, what information they should be aware of in the world of technology. I'm already seeing a crazy great group of folks in the live stream. Vazikos8, Vince Nova, Andy, Aditya, Heike just performed Rachmaninoff yesterday, so everyone give Heike a major thumbs up. Root Knight, Chatty Boy, Punch Coon. We've got a rockin' and rollin' live chat ready to go now. And we've got a ton of new stories to cover. I just want to kick this off. I had a lovely weekend. It was a delightful weekend. I got some really good downtime, some good family time. I'm thinking about, I've been in this sort of a whirlwind production schedule, trying to get videos out on phones. I'm trying to get back into writing some more editorials, like written articles, not just everything being video. And I woke up this morning and I was just in the worst mood, like proper foul, bad mood. And so I'm going to try to keep my crankiness from overly impacting the quality of the podcast that you're about to experience. I'm going to try and keep this moving a little bit lighter. Maybe find some wit or some comedy, but I have to warn you folks, going through all the news over the last couple days and trying to put together what this show is going to look like this morning, there was a lot of downer news. I'm a little concerned about the tone of this podcast being a little darker. Just fair warning. I'm trying to set the expectation, set the stage. What kind of ride you're on right now might be a little darker. So I'm very appreciative of those of you who are along for the ride, because we've got a little tech and politics to cover. Got a whole bunch of companies pulling the plug or getting bought out. And then for the second half of this podcast, I really want to dedicate some time to WWDC was last week. We actually hosted the podcast a little early last week, so we could all live tweet WWDC together. And so for the second half in the gadget block, we're going to try and focus on some of those announcements now that we're a week away from the initial WWDC keynote. That was not easy for me to say. So, Shaka Zulu sending some hearts my way. I appreciate that. We're going to soldier on. And try and find the silver linings and the positives for these things. From BunchCon, I like my podcast like I like my coffee, dark and tasteless. I mixed a ruthless pot of coffee this morning. I was really trying to find the maximum quantity of caffeine just to kind of get this week started. And Gary the Fireman gifted a tier one sub to Aditya Anil. Gary, thank you so much. And like routinely one of the top folks in this live chat gifting subscriptions. And I keep saying this every week, I am still terrible at unraveling all of the Twitch etiquette for that kind of support. But at least when I see it pop up in the chat, know that it's appreciated. And I'm really grateful and really thankful for folks supporting production on this channel. So, let's jump into some housekeeping because, like I said, really trying to crank some content, and I've got a ton of videos lined up, and I published a lot last week. So what are we at? 906. Do I have any over unders? Do we have any estimates on how long housekeeping is going to take? Because I'm going to try and move quick, and I think I've been doing pretty good. I mean, what happens is I get through housekeeping and then I get sidetracked, and then there's like a 5 minute lull in between housekeeping and actually getting into news. And we're not going to do that today. So what do we got? We got 8 minutes from Vince Nova. We've got Root Knight 5 saying 12. Gary the Fireman also saying 12. So, okay, between 8 and 12 minutes, my goal is to be done by 9:17 Pacific Daylight Time. Aditya Anil, 6 minutes and 9 seconds. Oh, LFA Review saying 14. He has no faith in me. Everyone say hey to LFA. If you love your ears, you should be subscribed to LFA Reviews. If you hate your ears, if you really don't like being able to hear pretty music, having headphones that fit you, having higher audio quality, and really consuming audio as an activity, then do not follow LFA. Don't. Just don't do it. All right. Housekeeping. From last week, I mean, we kind of loosely talked about this last week. I got the LG Velvet, so I did an unboxing video. We'll talk about the Velvet a little bit more this week too, just because I've been using it for a week and I've got some thoughts. But this was a very important video for me to put together. The Odyssey LCD-1, and I'm titling this my first planar magnetic headphones. It's planar. Is it planar or planar? Someone correct my pronunciation because I can never remember. I see planar and I think plantar fasciitis, which is probably incorrect. These are open back planar magnetic headphones, and they are absolutely incredible. Now, I was actually incorrect. These aren't technically my first planars because I did check out the head tracking for a Newegg video. I checked out the head tracking for the Odyssey Mobius, but that was more the tech demo of using a wireless gaming headset with head tracking. And when I was producing that video with Newegg, we did not spend as much time like really kind of digging into the nuances and the audio quality like I would normally do for one of my reviews. So the LCD ones are the first planers that I have lived with to analyze the audio quality. And if you needed an excuse to treat your ears better, the LCD ones are really impressive. It's worrying because I'm now looking at a whole new genre of really expensive headphones that my wallet will not be able to sustain. Moving right along, the embargo went up on reviews, but I refuse to call a video where I've only had the phone for a couple days a review. I'm getting even more cranky and persnickety about embargo week videos being called review. I'm wrapping up my review of the OnePlus 8 Pro because now I feel like the phone is in its lived-in state to call that the experience of really using this phone. And to me, that's a review. So what I'm going to be doing is this new series called Buy the Benchmarks. And so I have a Buy the Benchmarks out for the LG Velvet. We can look at some of the performance on Qualcomm's upper mid-tier Snapdragon 765. And then what are some of our expectations for a phone that's a little bit less expensive? We're talking like OnePlus 8 territory here in North America. I actually did get kind of a confirmation from LG that the conversion rate. So if you do the conversion in South Korea, the phone would be roughly $750. LG replied to one of my emails asking what the ballpark might be here in the United States. And they're saying it could be more than $100 less in the USA based on that conversion. So we could be looking at a dual screen phone for around $650, somewhere in that ballpark. And so we're in pretty, that's still expensive phone territory. So what kind of performance should you expect? And then what is the relationship between chipset and features? And Buy the Benchmarks is my way of trying to tackle that initial impression. Instead of it being an unboxing video, let's talk about video rendering. Let's talk about gaming performance. Let's talk about file compression. Maybe you are trying to replace a laptop with your phone. You know, RAR compression might matter in a situation like that. Moving right along, this one isn't really my wheelhouse. I am not a hardcore enterprise level, warehouse gadget user or reviewer, but I love rugged gadgets. So Panasonic sent over their FZ-A3, which is a military-grade ruggedized Android tablet with all kinds of modular bits and bobs and a dual battery system. A dual hot swappable battery system that I really wish we could get in the consumer space. It's just absolutely stunning hardware, completely overbuilt for what consumers need. I want us to have stuff like that so bad. So bad. So, I'm talking about it. I'm using it. I reviewed it, but obviously this isn't like a consumer focused gadget. Panasonic isn't really going to be selling this to, you can go and buy one if you want, but they're ridiculously expensive. This is an enterprise fleet tablet where you would have IT departments image very specific applications and usage for each tablet. But I just holding it, and it's built like a tank, and I want that so bad. I mean, since we don't really get Galaxy Actives anymore, I want any company to give us some properly rugged, like mil-spec rugged gadgets. Moving right along. TK Bay returns for another creator chat, just 101 podcast episodes later. He was the very first creator chat I recorded, and that was episode 58 of the SGG QA podcast. And he came back to talk about some of his transitions. This is an ongoing theme. And one of the main reasons why I started producing creator chat was to start highlighting some of the challenges that creators face and that our audiences don't always seem to understand what it is that a creator has to navigate these days. You fire up YouTube and you get a pretty video and you're like, hey, cool, thanks for making that. And then you kind of get on with your day. And I don't know that it's always accessible. I don't know that it's always conveyed all the back end, all of the research, how you use the products that you're reviewing, or what kind of work goes into the content that you create. And so TK gave some awesome advice to up-and-coming creators on his first appearance. And then he's spent that whole time living that advice as he's transitioned out of sort of an editor's role over at XDA. He's been focusing more on his own personal channels. He's been firing up Amazon as another method for monetizing and creating live streaming content. I mean, this dude's been hustling, and it shows. Like, his content has never been better. So again, another one. If you're not following TK Bay and you know you like wasting money on gadgets, then don't follow TK Bay. If you really want a good in-depth look at how this stuff functions and how you can customize it and how you can utilize it for more than just, you know, opening Facebook, then you should give TK Bay a follow. Kyle Ruggles, go TK Bay. And I believe you have this hashtag wrong, Aditya Anil. I believe it's hashtag TK my bay. Cause me, I'm the, you know. So System X10 loves wasting money. You should not follow TK Bay. You should not watch his videos. Walt Samarista is saying TKXDA Bay, and that's a major part of our conversation. He actually was quite candid with how the relationship between him and XDA was largely concluded. And with that, again, it's not like I'm trying to get folks to air dirty laundry, but I feel like now's the right time to talk about how do you get started? Do you work for a larger publication? Are they going to respect the amount of work that goes into creating content for their platform while you don't really build much of a following as on your own? That kind of stuff is really heady. And I feel now is the right time for people to be looking at how they can tell stories and how they can contribute to different communities and how they can create content. TK has a lot of life experience there. Moving right along, we still have two more to wrap up housekeeping. I'm definitely going to run long. LG Velvet setup dual screen gaming, right? Just a quick punchy little video. I have really enjoyed dual screen for gaming. I love twin stick shooters, arcade shooters, dungeon crawlers and looters and that kind of top down isometric gaming. It's still handy for racing. And the thing that I've noticed is you see a lot of LG videos where they say, oh, and you can use a second screen for gaming. And then all you see is the stock LG gamepad, which works differently than if you map on-screen controls to the second screen. I feel like that's a good trigger. If you look at Board at Works video, you see customized keyboards because he really games on phones and he's really trying to drive a game well on that second screen. If you look at some other reviews and all you see them pull up is the stock first gamepad template, that works differently than if you customize your own keyboard. Again, a different type of experience level, someone who might not be digging as deep into how this stuff really works. Just a little heads up there. Thought you might like to know. But if you want to check this out, this is kind of a companion piece, although without the attitude, to my dual screen power user video, just filling in some of the gaps on how to customize a good gaming setup. So lastly, let me scroll this over here. Because I have been trying to, I was originally planning on this being a video, but I am trying to write more, you know, just get the script done. And then do I really need to make this a video? YouTube's already killing my channel whenever I stray from like a set number of trending topics. So I turned this into a text piece. The title is Tech Reviewers, Familiar Doesn't Automatically Mean Better. And this is kind of a continuation on some of the conversations I've been trying to lead on bias and trying to disclose when a reviewer has a certain feeling, approach, or attitude. And one of the things that I've been having a lot of difficulty with is reading through some content where people are acting like familiarity is completely impossible to overcome. I'm familiar with this one keyboard app, so why would anyone ever convince me to use anything else because this is superior? And that's not true. I mean, again, I don't blame consumers. And I say this in this article. I don't blame consumers for sticking with what's familiar because you're just trying to make it through your day. That is a completely different conversation. I'm not encouraging people to change up, you know, oh, just switch from iOS to Android. It's so easy. BS. It is not easy to shift platforms. It's not easy to shift Android manufacturers. If you're used to Samsung skin and then you try and pick up a Sony, that's going to be unfamiliar, which is going to be frustrating to use as you retrain your muscle memory. But reviewers are different. I feel reviewers are not doing their job in picking up on the nuances of why these things are different. So they pull up two cameras and they just tap shutter buttons and they're like, oh, well, the phone I'm super familiar with gets better photos than the phone I've only used for an hour. It must not be as good. And that's the wrong conclusion to draw. So that's why this editorial exists. So that's housekeeping. Was that 13 minutes? Bah, dang it. Really thought I was doing a bit better there, but then I got hung up because I could talk about TK Bay all day. Hashtag TK My Bay. Punch gun. Bring back some gadget, bro. I really should. I mean, I was thinking about trying to work out the energy for doing that LG gaming piece, but just couldn't. I just needed it to be more straightforward. I've got so many videos to plan. I've got three videos just waiting for B-roll. I've got to finish the B-roll on three longer reviews. A camera deep dive for the OnePlus 8 Pro, the full review for the OnePlus 8 Pro. Actually, no, four videos. I've got an LG versus the Velvet versus OnePlus 8 video as sort of a companion piece to my LG versus OP comparison showdown. And then the TCL 10 Pro. All of those might be going up this week. Each one of those longer than 15-minute videos. Matt Tyler, my Xperia 1 Mark II had a small drop test last night. It passed with flying colors. So Matt was talking about his experiences using the Xperia 1 and how he was being really precious with it because he doesn't have a case yet. And then as soon as he was done with his live stream with Sam, he went and dropped his Xperia 1 Mark II. But that's housekeeping. I ran long. Whoever was, I think what LFA was closest. He said 14 minutes and I came in just around 13. So LFA reviews, you get the thumbs up kudos of, housekeeping glory. I don't have any other prize to give you or award to give you there. So, moving right along, we've got a ton of news to cover. All of those housekeeping stories, all of the articles we're going to be talking about, they will be in the show notes for this week's episode, which you can find on my website, somegadgetguy.com. It's going to be a lot. And I'm going to try and kind of group these stories together, move through them quickly, and then try and tap in on some comments. So if you're feeling strongly about any of these stories and you're trying to contribute to the conversation, I'm going to be kind of grouping and then commenting and the grouping and then commenting. There's a lot of follow-up on news that we've been talking about for a while. I love it. I jinxed it, man. And Al Spockley is saying hello all. Everyone say hello to, and I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm even pronouncing your handle right. Is it Al Spockley? I don't know. I apologize. All right. So, this is a follow-up to a story that I thought was kind of funny. Last week, we talked about social media, sort of the fallout of companies like Facebook playing really fast and loose with their terms of service when normal people post really incendiary comments. They get removed from the platform because that affects advertisers. But Facebook can then choose to allow the exact same content from elected officials to live on their platform. Someone actually did that as an experiment, literally just copied word for word everything that the Trump social media platforms were posting. And it took about a day for their new account to just get removed from Facebook. This is extremely problematic when a company like Facebook is trying to hide behind certain legal protections because they are not a publisher. They're just a distribution platform and they have no control over what people post on their site. But then they have a ton of editorial control over what they'll remove to appease advertisers. It sets up an unfair duality. They're trying to have their cake and eat it too. And this is why both liberals and conservatives seem to be gunning for some kind of social media reform. Again, it's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, if you really want to dig in a little deeper. Legal Eagle on YouTube has a great video kind of breaking some of this stuff down. I should really just, I mean, like anytime I talk about this, I should just say, go watch Legal Eagle. He'll describe all this stuff more eloquently than I can. But last week we saw REI pull the plug on their Facebook and Instagram advertising. And the initial knee-jerk reaction was like, big whoop, who cares? I saw so many comments, especially on Reddit, like, oh, like that's going to make a difference to Facebook. It really doesn't take much to kick off a trend. It only takes one or two companies to make some kind of public gesture saying, you know what, we're out. And then the credibility of that platform will start to crumble. Case in point. Following REI, here, let me go into screen share here. Following REI, Verizon is pulling advertising from Facebook and Instagram. This is, who wrote this up? Megan Graham over on CNBC. Verizon said on Thursday it is pulling advertising on Facebook until the company can create an acceptable solution that makes us comfortable. Now this is following marketers including Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, and REI. Well, wouldn't you know it, after Verizon pulled their advertising, Starbucks on their own blog, we believe in bringing communities together both in person and online, and we stand against hate speech. We believe more must be done to create welcoming and inclusive online communities, and we believe both business leaders and policymakers need to come together to effect real change. We will pause advertising on all social media platforms while we continue discussions internally with our media partners and with civil rights organizations in the effort to stop the spread of hate speech. And then Facebook policy, this is written up by Kari Paul over at The Guardian. Facebook policy changes fail to quell advertiser revolt as Coca-Cola pulls ads. And I want to scroll down. Where was... So Zuckerberg replied directly. They're trying to trot out... Facebook is trying to trot out new policies surrounding sensitive issues on their platform. Quote, I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to make progress on these challenges. I think we're going to be able to do that while maintaining our democratic traditions around free expression and voting. And I'm committed to making sure that Facebook is a force for good on this journey. Zuckerberg also said that the company will not be changing its policies that allow lying in paid political advertisements. Rashad Robinson of The Color of Change said the CEO's statement was 11 minutes of wasted opportunity to commit to change. Quote, Zuckerberg's new changes don't go nearly far enough. Labeling newsworthy content so the public can judge for themselves is not a new policy. It's more of the same, and it won't cut it. So we have seen a pretty substantial backlash against Facebook's inconsistent application of their own terms of service. So while I appreciate some of these concerns, again, Facebook is a private institution and we should not be looking to Facebook or Twitter as platforms for guaranteed First Amendment style free speech. We can't have this both ways. You know, I actually do kind of lean with a conservative argument that private corporations should be allowed to conduct business however they see fit. But I also agree with some notion that major telecommunications industries should face some kind of regulatory oversight. We just have no idea how to apply that to giant data-driven corporations in the 21st century. Our laws are woefully antiquated to handle that influx of enormous amounts of data. So we're stuck. We're proper stuck right now. And I have very little faith in our current leadership to try and help us untangle this situation. Why I have so little faith in the situation is because while all of this is going on, while private companies are trying to manipulate Facebook through advertising spends, what are our politicians concerned with? They're concerned with consumer encryption. So both liberals and conservatives, both Democrats and Republicans, are clamoring for some reform of how we regulate a company like Facebook. But what they're doing is implementing policy that would make it way easier for law enforcement to just have back doors into consumer electronics, gadgets, smartphones, computers. So this is coming by way of the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The Earn It bill is the government's plan to scan every message online, written up by Joe Mullen. From the article, imagine an internet where the law required every message sent to be read by government-approved scanning software. Companies that handle such messages wouldn't be allowed to securely encrypt them, or they'd lose legal protections that allow them to operate. That's what the Senate Judiciary Committee has proposed and hopes to pass into law. The so-called Earn It bill, E-A-R-N-I-T bill, I need to look up what that actually stands for. It's a terrible acronym. Sponsored by Senators Lindsey Graham, Republican, and Richard Blumenthal, Democrat, will strip Section 230 protections away from any website that does not follow a list of best practices, meaning those sites can be sued into bankruptcy. The best practices list will be created by a government commission headed by Attorney General Barr, who has made it very clear he would like to ban encryption and guarantee law enforcement legal access to any digital message. So, this is not good. We as general consumers, as users of social media platforms, we can't tell Facebook to change their practices. So you go down this rabbit hole of trying to encourage corporations to not spend money with Facebook, or you boycott products that are advertising in ways that you don't like how they're messaging. And that can motivate Facebook because the shareholders at Facebook are mad they're not going to make as much money after another quarterly report where they're losing ad dollars. Our process for also joining this conversation should be appealing to our elected officials to reform policy, which makes it significantly more difficult to get a handle on what's going on legally with these types of social media entities in the 21st century and the enormous impact they have on discourse, especially political discourse. So it's real creepy when, in the midst of all of this, we're looking at our elected officials on both sides of the aisle, and I hate playing the, you know, enlightened centrist role here. I'm definitely a left-leaning individual, but Richard Blumenthal, man, not a good look. Not good. We have been debating the merits of consumer encryption, what, since DOS? If we believe in freedom and liberty, then we also need to believe in consumer privacy, in citizen privacy. And you cannot do that in a 21st century era. There is no such thing as a safe back door. Like, you can't make as soon as you make a hole in a product, it will be exploited. It's a guarantee that if you weaken the security of some type of computer, that will be exploited. We see that on the regular. We've been talking about iOS exploits. We've been talking about some of the Windows malware, macOS. There is no such thing as a foolproof, secured computing system. And if you build it insecure by design, it's not going to stay with just law enforcement. So that's what our committees, the committees that are going to help us shape the future of tech policy, are focused on encryption, when really we've got humongous issues with online discourse. And I can't even, it activates my stutter. From Alice Bockley, and see, this is one of the sticky questions, because we have some very serious grown-up conversations that need to be held. This is a great comment. Is it really a typical private company, though, when it's providing communication services to billions of people around the world? Also, private businesses are often regulated. Why not regulate Facebook and Twitter in the same way like some other type of a media company? And that's the type of grown-up discourse that we need to have. It's less so in the United States. But in other areas of the world, the internet has become synonymous with Facebook because of how Facebook will invest in local infrastructure. Kind of like AOL. You didn't really go to the internet. You stayed in this little pretty AOL walled garden of the internet. This little private intranet of fun little activities. That's probably not conducive to free and open discourse. But because that's a little less so here in the United States with the way that we regulate communication and speech and how money influences all of that, we need to re-examine how these laws are written to apply to 21st century economy. This is such a huge legal quandary. I don't know what that should look like. I have feelings on it, and I'm pretty sure my feelings are incomplete for guiding what the future of this infrastructure should look like. It's going to be a lot. Kyle Ruggles. Sorry, that cracked me up. Kyle Ruggles, two cans and a string for me. JT Moat, IMO, social media should look like Discord. Communities you choose to join and are based on inner communication rather than shoving off the highlights of your life and generating FOMO. And I don't know. I mean, other people here disagree with me if you feel like me and JT are off the pulse here. But I feel like people my age and younger are now starting to drift towards that more community-based approach. Discord has been such a huge force in me finding some joy on the internet again. I love my friends. I've got my, I don't really keep lists, but I've got my kind of collection of buddies on Twitter, people that I'll generally sort of tweet with and interact with. But drilling down into not totally private, but kind of loosely gate-kept communities focused on specific topics where they're also better self-policed than, say, a Reddit model where moderators can be gamed for larger subreddits and then that can manipulate the tone of the Reddit. And we've seen a lot of Reddit capture. I mean, there are rumors that we might see a mass banning of subreddits again because of how Reddit does business with advertisers, and advertisers don't want to be associated with certain types of groups. So for me, I feel like especially people younger than me are already creating the next phase of the internet based on that kind of localized community approach, which again, I feel like they deserve to have encryption tools if they want to make their community properly private and guarantee that the data that they send back and forth is better localized to their community. I feel like that should be the gig. Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together. The Sentinel 909, time to usher in an era of European app supremacy. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because we have a couple other stories too. Some news that actually recently just broke. I'm going to shift my order around here because we were talking about privacy. Hold on, I need to find this and this and this. Okay, so TK Bay did a stream on Saturday. I'm not really going to make all of this rhyme. For a second there, I was going to like, how can I make all of these pieces rhyme? TK was talking to Saf, Super Saf, about some of his recent strategy in diversifying, you know, not just putting all of his content on YouTube, but really trying to go where audiences might follow One of the services that got a lot of conversation was TikTok. TikTok of late has become a very divisive service to talk about. And there was a lot of angst in the comments of TK's video. If you know TK Bay, he is fair. He is even-handed. He is considerate. He is thoughtful. But there are some concerns over TikTok's influence with the Chinese government, over the platform's security and privacy applications, and how certain regions of the world treat different populations, especially minority populations within their borders. So there was some very angry commenting happening during that live stream. Whether or not that's the appropriate forum to have those types of debates is a question that each content creator needs to kind of hash out for themselves. TK is not an individual who I feel is overly political and likely appreciates those concerns, but that wasn't really the conversation that him and Saf were trying to have. The conversation he and Saf were trying to have was focused on people spreading their stuff out, which is the right advice. Right now, TikTok is one of the fastest growing social media applications in the world. As a content creator, you examine that for the potential you might be able to tap into with various different audiences. I don't use TikTok. I'm not likely to use TikTok initially just because I don't really like how the platform is structured. But we've got some stories here. Real quick, Aditya Anil, TK is the most wholesome and one of the most knowledgeable people in the industry. Anyone with self-respect and respect for another human being would have been more civilized and would know when to and when not to lash out. I feel the same way. I'm very protective of TK. TK is my brother from another mother. And I don't know I can point to many people in my industry that are as giving with their time, as thoughtful with their content, and as measured with their application as TK. And really, he deserves an extra zero at the end of his subscribers count because he is genuinely living the great advice that he gives to other people. But IAR, ER, 1980, just beat me to the punch on one of the stories we're going to talk about with TikTok. So if you catch ER, 1980 in the live chat, you're going to get a sneak peek at what we're going to talk about here in just a sec. So first of all, got to point out this story from Mashable. Apple's iOS 14 beta shows apps like TikTok still spy on your iPhone clipboard. So this was written up by Sasha Lekach. A copy-paste issue on iPhones is still running wild on more than 50 apps, including TikTok, numerous news apps, and games like Bejeweled. The clipboard privacy breach was first reported back in March and exposed that some apps could see iPhone users' clipboard contents, whether it be a credit card number, password, or random link. The apps were accessing the copied text or media every time users opened them without users knowing what was happening. At Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference in June 2020, the newest iPhone operating system, iOS 14, was introduced, and with it, a new way to notify users about apps looking at your iPhone data. Other type of app data access will be self-reported in what Apple is calling privacy nutrition labels. There is no reason for TikTok to be looking at your clipboard data. So we got a problem there. Again, it's proper notification of what is the app doing. And TikTok is getting banned in India. So this is coming by way of XDA developers, written up by Michelle Rahman. India bans 59 Chinese apps, including TikTok, Me Community, and Clash of Kings. I'm assuming it's Me Community because it's from Xiaomi. Lots of Xiaomi apps. Multiple apps from Xiaomi are getting included in this 59 app ban, but TikTok is getting some of the big headlines. The government of India, quote, has decided to disallow the usage of these apps used in both mobile and non-mobile internet-enabled devices. The Ministry of Electronics and IT notes raging concerns on aspects relating to data security and safeguarding the privacy of Crore, C-R-O-R-E, Indians. I'm not entirely sure what that word means. The ministry has, quote, received many complaints from various sources, including several reports for misuse of some mobile apps available on Android and iOS platforms for stealing and surreptitiously transmitting users' data in an unauthorized manner to servers which have locations outside of India. And we recently covered Xiaomi too, where they're sending your private, your incognito browsing data to services, and you have to jump through hoops to turn off data tracking in incognito, but your normal browser data is still being sent off. Well, apparently numerous other Xiaomi apps are engaged in very similar data harvesting, and TikTok seems to be doing a lot of that too. I'm not entirely sure on this third piece of the TikTok story how valid this is. I am not a security researcher. I am not an app reverse engineer, but this has been making some rounds. And this is someone on Reddit. Who is the user on Reddit? Bangor Lol, B-A-G-O-R-L-O-L, wrote up a reply to a story about TikTok, a video that someone posted just saying, hey, you should uninstall TikTok, where he claims to have reverse engineered TikTok and is detailing all of the ways that it sends information to Chinese servers. So I'm also going to link to this individual post. This one I'm taking with a grain of salt just because I'd like to see this verified by another security researcher panel, someone else that I know can sort of verify some of these claims. But here, this is from his post. His post is really long. I mean, this is a kind of an intense write-up. But here's where I want to start from. TikTok is a data collection service that is thinly veiled as a social network. If there is an API to get information on you, your contacts, or your device, they're using it. Phone hardware, your CPU type, number of cores, hardware ID, screen dimension, DPI, memory usage, disk space, other apps you have installed. And I've seen some I've deleted show up in their analytics payload, maybe using a cached value. Everything network related, IP, local IP, router Mac, your Mac, Wi-Fi address, point name, whether or not your phone is rooted or jailbroken. And some variants of the app had GPS pinging enabled at the time, roughly once every 30 seconds. And this is enabled by default if you ever location tag a post. And they set up a local proxy server on your device for transcoding media, but that can be abused very easily as it has zero authentication. And apparently, a good chunk of this data, depending on app version and platform and whether or not you're on Android or iOS, is being sent up to Chinese servers over unsecured protocols. So here's from the rest of it. On top of the above, they weren't even using HTTPS for the longest time. They leaked users' email addresses in their HTTP REST API, as well as their secondary emails used for password resets. Don't forget about users' real names and birthdays too. It was all publicly viewable a few months ago. I don't know what that means, MITM'd the application. This is a lot. And Sentinel-909, and this is going hand in hand with a large Chinese phone boycott in India at the moment. Root 95, I'd say India has the right idea here. There are very complex concerns. We've talked about some of these issues in the past. A long time ago on the Bored at Work podcast, we've been talking about blue phones, where they would sort of send up information that they didn't need to. Xiaomi was the most recent. OnePlus got caught up in some of this. Huawei had some issues where they started setting up European servers to comply with Europe's privacy and data protection policies. I feel like this is just the beginning rabbit holes, the little threads, the little tendrils of information that we're going to start untangling a wider web of content, data access, and privacy. This is a follow-up story from here on. not necessarily just because of TikTok or the conversation that Saf had with TK or one social media network. It's entire platforms now, which seem to be pointing more towards consumers of those products as a part of the product to sell to other corporations. I have some concerns over Xiaomi's business practices when so much of their money is built on, so much of their profit base is built on services. Around the world, you don't have the same entrenched Google services base on a phone. So Xiaomi puts out a bunch of services, they sell their devices at, you know, maybe even at a loss, and then make up their money with services over time. That sounds fine. That sounds like a good deal for consumers. For all the people that complain when I say a OnePlus 8 isn't too expensive because they can buy a, you know, a really cheap phone with a Snapdragon 865, I would worry that one of the things you're compromising to achieve that lower price point is some of the business practices we're talking about here in protecting your personal information. This is something that I hope we can get some kind of confirmation on over this week. I would really like to hear what other evidence the Indian government has. Maybe help influence what the next generation of services should resemble. Just as we were talking about, like, man, maybe I should pull the plug on Facebook and just live in Discord. And I think I'd be happier for it. From Matt Tyler, this happens a lot with apps that have a large audience during the spike. A story comes out about how it's taking your data. Honestly, sometimes it's hard to follow truth from lies. It's not even truth from lies. I don't think we've encountered a story. I'm trying to think. I don't think we've encountered a story where someone made a securities claim and there wasn't a reply that indicated there was some validity to that claim. The closest I can think of where all we got was a denial and a removal was Samsung. So Samsung used a special third-party plugin for their storage cleaner. And someone was noticing the storage cleaner sending information, potentially personally identifiable information, up to Chinese servers. And this was explained as, well, this is how this storage cleaning app functions, so that it can properly decide what information to remove from your phone and what information should stay. But very quietly, almost immediately after that story broke, in the successive software update coming from Samsung, they just removed any mention of the third-party entity that was responsible for making that plugin. Again, they denied and then they pulled it. So I don't understand, well, if there was nothing going on, why would you pull it? You know, if there was no issue with using that third-party service to verify the content on your phone, why would you remove any mention of that third-party service? And also, did you even remove the service, or did you just remove mention of the service? You licensing it in a different way, and then you just obfuscate the name. So it's not so much lies. The problem is we get hung up on a knee-jerk, incendiary headline. TikTok is stealing your data and sending it to China. And that's all consumers are really going to engage with. That's what's going to float through Twitter and Facebook, and people are going to pat themselves on the back for being so clever and so smart so as to not use TikTok. And then we're going to miss the nuance and all of the other potential security concerns with a whole host of other apps and services that might be engaged in similar practices, and consumers never really get that extra, that second helping, that follow-up, or that legit education on what's really going on with their data, so they're never properly informed as to how best to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. Route 95 in communist China, you don't buy phone. Phone buys you. From EAR 1980, I think Chinese manufacturers have approximately 80% of smartphone market share in India, with only Samsung the other major seller. I actually don't know what India's market looks like, but you know, I kind of feel like across the board, we could do with a bit more competition in many markets. You know, I enjoyed my Sony. My LGs and some of my Samsungs are built in Taiwan. There's HTC is going to mount a comeback. You know, it's okay to look at other solutions that are kind of being built and drawn from other areas of the world. And Route 95, with Facebook coming pre-installed on so many phones, can I be sure I'm not leaking data to them even if I'm not on the platform? You absolutely are. Let's say you completely nuke all of your Facebook accounts. As soon as you interact with someone who's on Facebook, Facebook is still able to generate a profile on you. If you interact with any app or web service that uses some type of Facebook cookie, even if you're not signed in, Facebook has a profile on you. You cannot escape. The best you can do, you can like set up containers and you can set up kind of a fenced off garden. I love Firefox for delivering. Mozilla delivers a first party Facebook container. And it's really enlightening when you see the little container icon pop up on a website, which has nothing to do with Facebook, but they're using Facebook cookies or Facebook trackers. It's pretty insane. Like how much data is being sifted through. And I have to believe Google is doing the same. And we know that Apple is also doing a fair amount of ID tracking and face tracking. We're going to talk about WWDC, but I loved in the middle of their keynote, they were like, yeah, and if you tag people in your photos, well, we'll track their faces for your security camera. Moving right along. You're like, you're doing face ID, face tracking on anyone who has been tagged in my photos app. And it's linked to my security camera, so you can identify someone when they show up to my doorbell, and you're just going to gloss over that. That's not going to be a part of your, we care about privacy and security conversation. They're like, okay, face tracking, love you, bye. Woo. It's good times. All right. We've got two quick little, let me make sure I've made it through my lineup here. We've got two more news stories that made me sad. Well, one more that made me sad and one more that I kind of shrugged at. But Microsoft, we talked about how Google kills services left and right. Microsoft killing some stuff over this last week. The first one was, this one was obnoxiously trying to be sneaky. So in the middle of WWDC, a number of little press releases started popping up. I got emails and then some people were tweeting about it. And there was this little grumble in the background of WWDC about how Microsoft is killing Mixer and is basically just going to try and move everyone over to Facebook Gaming. So this is from the actual Microsoft Mixer blog. From the beginning, Mixer has been about creating the most engaging and interactive live streaming experience. We set out to help streamers build great communities based on deep engagement with their audience. You all have been amazing throughout this journey. The Mixer community has focused on creating welcoming and inclusive communities, and you should be proud of what you have accomplished together. So we're selling it to Facebook. I want you to notice, you know, what are some of the issues that Facebook has been facing? Again, this commentary on welcoming and inclusive communities and reducing hate speech, all of that language right at the top of this press release. Not that I don't think those are good goals. I'm doubtful of Facebook's intentions in those regards. And so then the whole post breaks down how long Mixer service is going to run. Actually, it's right here. Let me say that. Mixer service will continue to run through July 22nd, 2020. They're pulling the plug in 23 days. They're giving you a month's notice. After that, Mixer.com will redirect to FB.GG, Facebook's desktop home for gaming video. Mixer broadcasting on Xbox One will be temporarily disabled, and the Mixer apps will notify or redirect viewers to continue watching their favorite streamers at Facebook Gaming. Whew. We encourage all Mixer viewers to spend their remaining embers and sparks to help support your favorite Mixer partners and streamers. Mixer partners will receive double payment for all of their earnings in the month of June. So your support of embers, sparks, and channel subscriptions for Mixer partners will go even further during the rest of the month. And apparently Ninja, who was it? Ninja and someone else who were exclusive, are gonna be free agents again. There's rumors that who is it, Dr. Disrespect, was surreptitiously banned from Twitch because they were talking about setting up some type of alternative streaming platform. This is again lots of drama happening in the world of game streaming, and just sad. I'm just sad. Again, Facebook is an amoeba, the blob, you know, absorbing other content, other communities, other services. And Microsoft, so disappointed. You've got xCloud that's starting to fire up. You've got Game Pass. You've got all of these amazing services built for gamers. Stick it out. Build your community authentically. Don't just hire one high-profile streamer and expect all the monies. Grow it. Grow it for real. And I'm so tired of companies dabbling. They kind of dip their toe in the space and, oh, well, we didn't immediately undo Twitch, so I guess it's not viable, better leave. And all that does is reinforce why no one should compete with Twitch or why no one should try to compete against YouTube. It sets up the consumer expectation that it's never worth it to try any other service except that which is most popular, which is horrifically destructive to discourse and to speech and to various other platforms. Matt Tyler, I feel like Facebook is a weekly section for us at the moment. Lots of Facebook adjacent news. Punchkun, I honestly don't know anyone who has ever actively sought out Facebook gaming content, and I'm a fairly large Facebook page admin. I have automatically set up a stream. So you can watch this on Facebook from my own personal Facebook account. I'll be curious to see, like, does this automatically redirect to some kind of Facebook gaming page? Because I'm not doing a lot of game streams. I'm doing a lot of podcasting. Do I leave it on autopilot? I'll leave this up to the community. Should I leave Facebook streaming on autopilot the way I have? Or should I just, you know, whittle that down like I've pulled the plug on YouTube? Drop me your thoughts. I'll be curious to see where you land. Q3 Becker, I thought the Dr. Disrespect drama was because of some anonymous harassment complaints. And so the drama and the permaban coming from allegations. As far as I've been able to untangle, and I am not deep into the world of game streamers, his sponsors came back fairly quickly. His initial replies have been very carefully worded, but that doesn't seem like there have been any credible allegations against him. It seems more like he was in breach of his agreement with Twitch about seeking out competing platforms to stream on. I could totally be wrong, and maybe new news has broken since then, but I think Twitch also tried to time the ban for Dr. Disrespect while Twitch was dealing with these allegations of abuse on their platform with other streamers. And the conspiracy theory is that Twitch is trying to link Dr. Disrespect to a situation he is not a part of. I have no idea how accurate that is. That is completely speculation from the darkest edges and slimiest corners of Reddit. The Reddit gaming community, not super nice. But the one that is actually making me a bit more sad. If you followed any of my videos or if you've listened to my podcast at all, You know that if I get kind of soapboxy or become a zealot about anything, it's not one brand, it's the idea of competition. I am obnoxiously, anxiously a defender of what I feel improves competition for consumers, as I feel like that's the only thing that motivates improvements. If it's broadband, if it's smartphones, if it's computers, if it's software, if you don't have choice in the market and real choice that's accessible to consumers, then your products do not get better. So even if I'm a fan of one company, if they don't have any competition, I feel like their products stagnate because they aren't really working to improve the consumer experience. So even when something's significantly less popular, I appreciate those efforts where a company is trying to compete. And I feel like that deserves more conversation than the player who's established and winning in that market as like a counterbalancing force. So which made me really sad when the news broke that Microsoft is permanently closing its retail stores, written up by Todd Hazelton over at CNBC. Microsoft on Friday announced it will permanently close its 83 Microsoft Store retail locations. It will instead focus on its online store at Microsoft.com, where customers can go for support, sales, training, and more. There was another line in here. Maybe it wasn't in this article. But essentially, Microsoft isn't just going to immediately gut those jobs from the 83 retail stores. They're going to be looking at other places where those people might be able to contribute to the Microsoft mission. I'm really bummed about this. The Microsoft store in our local mall was directly across the hallway from the aisle from an Apple store, three times its size. And I would look up on, you could go to like Microsoft.com/store or Microsoft.com/micro, something like that. And you could look up events. And there was very rarely good events going up at our local mall. And it just felt like such a wasted opportunity for this cute little retail space to become part of a broader community. You know, gaming tournaments, you know, they have a little Xbox setup. You could pull people in for that. VR demos, all the things that the larger Microsoft stores and other locations seem to do really well. And it's so disappointing because there are so few places where someone can go and get hands-on and really, you know, kind of play with different solutions and different options. I mean, there's a reason why the Apple Store layout is so attractive to consumers. Lots of space, elbow room, rows of products. You sit there and test drive some Bluetooth headphones. Employees will kind of tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, you want to buy anything? But they'll leave you alone and you can sit and listen to a huge catalog of music on an iPhone, on Bluetooth headphones right there in the store, and hands-on and demos and classes. And that resonates. There's a reason why Amazon is looking to get back into brick and mortar. Is, you know, online retail is dominated by Amazon, but there are still consumers out there who are going to struggle with making a purchasing decision if they can't interact with a product, hold it, consider alternatives, be there in the store and consider that. And traditional retail channels have completely ceded their advantage. You know, like department stores have completely rolled over and given up to the world of online retail, as opposed to leveraging the advantage they have over online retail. And so it's critically sad. I mean, Best Buy? You could go check out a Surface at Best Buy. And maybe it even works and maybe it doesn't. But, you know, I don't think that experience is as nice as what Microsoft could control with their own retail setup. In the same way that, like, if you're anywhere near an Apple store, you're not going to go to Target to try and poke around on an iPhone. You're not going to go to Best Buy to try and poke around on a MacBook. If you really want to check out what that hardware is like, you're going to go to an Apple store. And Microsoft had started building an infrastructure like that, where it could then also be used as mini warehouse space, training space, tech support space, so many benefits for having a physical location. And now they're going to pull the plug. So that makes me very, very, very upset. Wes Easton on Facebook. And crazy old men can just sit there in the Apple store and watch YouTube. We'll be lucky if they're just watching YouTube. from Dale. It was also right. My Microsoft store was right across from the Apple store at our mall, too. It's so weird. The thing that makes it a little sad is you walk by the Apple store and it's always like full. There are always people lounging around in there, and you'd turn, and sometimes there'd be a group of people in the Microsoft store, but most of the time I was there, it'd be like five Microsoft store employees kind of looking at their phones and like one person sort of looking around an Xbox display. And I know that's not a great look, but I feel like the lesson to learn isn't, okay, well, it wasn't immediately successful, so we just pulled the plug. I feel like the lesson is, what cultivates a more engaging user experience, and how do we tell a story about our products when we can have someone's physical presence there? Like, it's just such a missed opportunity. It makes me really sad. Route 95, it's a sad situation. From Matt Tyler, having a specific company-based store to talk with specific company employees is something that is needed. And it shouldn't go away. Like Samsung was hugely successful setting up pop-up kiosks. They'd set up like a living room in the middle of a mall, and you would see people like hanging out there. Amazon did the same thing before they started getting back into retail space, where you'd have like an Amazon kiosk for all the things that were like Amazon Fire and tablets and TV sticks. And then like you could see what smart speakers were doing. And it was this great little layout. You know, your impact is minimal. I'm sure that's expensive if you're trying to do that with a lot of reach across malls around the country, but it's huge mind share. It's the same thing. You know, like in so many areas, you can walk into a mall and see a Tesla stand, but it's not a Tesla store. Like you can't buy a Tesla there, but you can see it. It's, you know, physically, it's right there. You can be in the presence of a Tesla, and it can generate some excitement. I really feel like we're missing that today. I really want a company like B&H to look at retail shops. I would love to walk into a B&H here in Southern California and go hands-on with lenses. And maybe I don't actually buy it there, but I place an order with bnh.com while I'm in the middle of handling some of this gear, you know, like that synergy. And then because you have a physical location, it affords you some stock that you can pile up, that you can use as warehouse space to fulfill orders, to handle support issues, to handle repairers. Like there's so much that you can do with that and interact with your consumers. And just fewer and fewer companies seem to have the wherewithal, the patience, or the resources to make use of that. Oh no, JT Moat, the Google Fiber store I went to had a single person not employed there using the fast Wi-Fi on his lunch break. I went to pick up a router. And Dale also confirming that too. For sure, the Apple store was always busier. The micro stores looked a lot cooler though. Again, not so much that I think they look cooler. I don't like the current stark, like almost antiseptic look of an Apple store, but also just more product categories at the Microsoft store. You could play with Android phones. You could play with an Xbox. You could play with all kinds of different computers, monitors, tablets. I mean, it's just, I liked going in there because there was just a sort of a bigger spread of different gadgets. Wes Easton, Sammy's camera will destroy B&H to the death. Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey there, Juan, and hey there, you. This is Jason Howell from All About Android over at the twit.tv podcast network. Juan has been a guest on All About Android a number of times. In fact, we have awesome guests on the show each and every week, and we'd love for you to check out the show if you haven't already. twit.tv/AAA is where you can go to find new episodes of All About Android. Each and every week, we talk about the top Android news, hardware, apps. We have a reviews portion called the Arena. It's very competitive, but in a fun way. We have a really great time doing this show, and we would love for you to join us sometime and check it out. We get journalists from throughout the Android world joining us. We even sometimes get Googlers who are actually making Android on the show to talk about what we love so much about the world of Android. That's twit.tv/AAA for new episodes of All About Android each and every Tuesday. All right, Juan, back to you.
I do enjoy me some Sammy's cameras. I did the Sony workshops at our local Sammy's. My hair is really annoying me. All right. We should take a quick break. This is the part of the podcast where we plug the subreddit. I'm going to make this real quick. Every podcast has a subreddit. Some subreddits are built to tell the hosts how great they are. That's not my gig. Some are really about collecting the news stories that they want the podcast to talk about. My subreddit, just like many of my conversations, focused on helping to promote content creators that we feel deserve more attention. So if you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, you will find a small but growing community of people sharing, upvoting. Upvotes are critical. And more comments on some of these posts. You will probably find a content creator you've never seen before, and they might become one of your favorites, but I'm pretty confident that a lot of the people on this list likely not being promoted by the YouTube algorithm that hard. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Here are the top stories of the week. A number one with a bullet, Issa. Issa does tech with her LG Velvet camera test. A great video from a lovely perspective. Issa is going to be joining me on a creator chat this week. We've got an episode in the can and another really interesting conversation talking about her experiences, not only as a tech reviewer, but as a female tech reviewer with certain expectations from different members of our tech community. However, you might want to take that. I think it's an excellent conversation from a perspective we don't always get to hear of in the geek dude bro world of tech. Number two, this is coming by way of Jim's Review Room. This is a channel with 970,000 subscribers, and he's closing his YouTube channel. Closing another chapter in my life, goodbye Jim's Review Room. And Jim has kind of a heartfelt video talking about his experiences on YouTube and why he's pulling the plug. And apparently he's going to be moving to Twitch, trying to find more fun in his daily tech life and in his production schedule. And I feel like this is a growing situation with some of the larger YouTube channels. Sorry, I had to take a drink of water there. From Heike, no, Jim is closing his channel. I feel like there's good evidence to suggest that this is going to be a continuing trend. Lots of major YouTubers also looking at maybe they could host podcasts. From IAR 1980, ER 1980, his channel on Twitch is Jimmy Energy. So I would recommend you go give him a follow. I liked his videos. Number three, rounding out the top three, coming by way of Tana So Lit. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. What's up with iOS 14? New features walkthrough, Tana So Lit. 3,700 subscribers. Tana's channel is sort of an after dark channel for me. He uses lots of swear words and he's funny, but he's going through an iOS 14 walkthrough. Then rounding out the rest of the top stories, an LG Velvet review from Issa, a dual screen case video from Josh Vergara, some doofus unboxing the LG Velvet. This one was a great video. Cobra Told Ya went to the Peterson. Okay, so if you're in Southern California and you're a gearhead like me, you should live at the Peterson. It is a wonderful car museum. I heart it mucho. So Cobra went because they have a Tesla Cybertruck on display. And he's got this cute thumbnail where he's like circling all of the imperfections and unfinished seams and all of the problems with the Tesla Cybertruck. But again, this is the kind of thing, like, where else would you get to go see a Tesla Cybertruck in person? You know, they're not going to go at a Tesla pop-up kiosk in the mall. So he went to the Peterson and he actually checked it out. We've got the Sony Xperia 1 Mark II review from Techspert. We've got a Panasonic Toughbook review. We've got some jerk in a hat talking about LG dual screen gaming. And rounding out the top 10, we've got Painfully Honest Tech, LG V60 after 1 month, goodbye iPhone. Lots of really aggressive comments on that video. Jason was recently on the Across the Pondcast with Sam and Matt talking about just, man, how visceral the gamesmanship, you know, is getting in mobile. And then, like I was saying, so here, this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about when some reviewers do their job better than others. I think that we're past our top 10, but Board at Work put out LG Velvet Gaming Test, PUBG Mobile, Fortnite, COD Mobile. So what do we see in this screen grab, in this thumbnail, where Board at Work and Abong is holding a Velvet playing COD? We do not see the stock LG controller, because Enabong games on phones for real. Enabong has a custom controller set up for exactly his claw-style grip on the Velvet to play this game. That, to me, would indicate someone who was really digging into the features of the dual-screen case on the LG, as opposed to someone who is only casually mentioning that these things exist and then not really trying to use them or verify them or anything like that. So, again, if I'm talking mobile gaming, I'm way more inclined to listen to someone like Enabong Etta or TK Bay than someone who is just reading off a spec sheet to pretty B-roll. That's just how I feel. All right, that's going to wrap us up. Lots of killer content. We're at 950 subscribers on the subreddit. This is growing organically. It's starting to pick up more momentum. We're seeing more submissions every day. We're seeing new. Every time I go, I see a content creator I've never seen before. There is a broad tech discussion that's happening out there, and it's not well represented on Facebook. It's not well represented on YouTube, but there's really interesting content being produced every day. So my plea, as always, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Check it out. Help support your favorite content creators. Some active participation means the world to people that are making content on the regular. It's not enough to just kind of passively watch a video and go, oh, that was cool, I hope they make another one. Sharing, upvoting, commenting, it all helps. So the subreddit is my one small attempt at trying to help grow that conversation for other people that big channels and small channels probably aren't doing right by YouTube's algorithm, and everyone could use a little help these days. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Tell them Juan sent you, because when you tell them that Juan sent you, you're basically just telling me that I sent you, and you should check it out. Matt Tyler, I'll be uploading the show with Jason to the Reddit tomorrow if anyone wants to give it an upvote. He's working the subreddit pretty hard. I appreciate Matt's hustle. It's good times, because it's good content, but it's also good times. All right, getting into the gadget block. Remember how I said at the beginning of this podcast there was lots of bummer news? Lots of stuff that made me sad. I'm going to chew through these pretty quickly. First of all, I like more competition. So I'm a little concerned about this story here in the world of cameras. I shoot on Panasonic. In terms of bang for buck, I feel like it's some of the best options that you can arrive at a high quality 4K video. I'm streaming this right now on a G85. I use a G9 now for a lot of my video production and B-roll. So when I see Olympus getting out of the camera game, it makes me really sad. This is the end of an era. Now, it's not to say that this manufacturing is really completely going away, but it's going to be a diminished brand in the world of consumer cameras. So this is an article written up by Steve Dent. Olympus is giving up on cameras, but the second line of the headline, it'll be acquired by the company that bought Sony's VAIO division. So if you've been paying attention and digging kind of deep, Sony VAIOs went away, but a firm bought up the VAIO trademark, the brand, the operations, and are still running it. So now that firm is going to own the Olympus consumer and mirrorless camera division. And I don't know if you've ever played, I mean, the OMDs were great cameras. I used a Mark I and a Mark II. I reviewed both of those. I never got my hands on the Mark III, unfortunately. But this is from, I think this is from the actual press release, isn't it? So from the article anyway, Olympus has implemented measures to cope with the extremely severe digital camera market due to, amongst others, rapid market shrink caused by the evolution of smartphones. Olympus has improved the cost structure by restructuring the manufacturing basis and focusing on high-value added interchangeable lenses, aiming to rectify the earnings structure to those that may continue generating profit even as sales dwindle. Despite all such efforts, Olympus's imaging business recorded operating losses for three consecutive fiscal years up to the term ended in March 2020, so they're pulling the plug. Route Night 5 feels like when Kodak bowed out. It absolutely does. I don't think we're going to see the Olympus name. So Kodak basically became a licensing exercise. I have a Kodak Micro Four Thirds mirrorless camera. I actually let Lex use it as her photography solution. So my four-year-old is running around with a pretty good Micro Four Thirds camera. Interchangeable lens system. It's super adorable. But I don't think we're going to see that swap here. I don't think Olympus is gonna give the Olympus name to a firm that is going to own the camera business from here on out. So I would imagine, kind of like VAIO, we're going to see some brand like the OMD or the, what is I don't know how to pronounce it. Z-U-I-K-O. It's the lens that's on my G85 right now. So Olympus has this beautiful 17 millimeter F1.8 that I use for my streams and for talking to camera. Great. It's a great tiny little prime lens for Micro Four Thirds. So that Zuiko, someone tell me how to pronounce it. I have no idea how to pronounce it. I've been using their lenses for years. I feel like that might be the potential brand. You could like get an OMD EM Mark IV from Zuiko. Kyle Ruggles, I always say Zuko. Okay, I like that because it's kind of like The Last Airbender, right? Zuko! No? Okay, anyway. So something like that. Or could be kind of cool if this firm is really owns and is operating these different labels, maybe the VAIO label just becomes the next generation of consumer electronics. Like you just staple them together. You get VAIO lenses with the M Zuiko label on them for the glass and VAIO laptops and VAIO camera bodies. Like that could be pretty cool. I mean, I'm trying to temper this. Remember I said I was super cranky. I'm trying to find the silver lining. That's what I'm trying to find is the silver lining. Like this brand could be piecemealing in a new consumer electronics umbrella company. That could be cool. I don't know that it'll be cool. It probably won't be cool, but I'm hoping it's cool. I want more competition. And especially I probably should move on from Micro Four Thirds, but I like my little Lumix cameras. And the G9 is such a beautifully built camera. And I'm doing more in shooting video than really taking those cameras out to shoot stills these days. And it's just such a snappy little camera. And I love the video from it. And I really hope Micro Four Thirds is able to kind of iterate as an alternative to APS-C. I like it. I like tiny little lenses and smaller camera bodies. And it's cute. I like it because my camera is adorable. So it would be nice if they could maintain some competition in the space for people like me. It's just a bummer that I don't buy cameras nearly as often as what they would need to support that. Okay, moving right along. Another piece of bad news. Who's ready to get bummed out? Okay, we thought phone prices this year were expensive, and we saw significant rises thanks to 5G and Qualcomm's influence over even LTE modems being separate components. Well, it looks like it's going to get even worse next year. So this is from phonearena.com, written up by Alan Friedman. This is why flagship 5G Android phones will rise in price next year. This is all super specious. I do not know how accurate or verified this information is, but rumors are pointing to some very aggressive negotiating between Xiaomi and Qualcomm over the price of what their next gen chipset is going to be. The current platform is the Snapdragon 865. We're assuming it's going to be, the next one's going to be the 875. And we're hearing, again, not verified, not confirmed. This is private negotiations between two multi-billion dollar corporations, that the 875 could be a $100 component price hike over the 865. So people keep fighting me on this, but there's a reason why in North America, 5G capable phones are significantly more expensive than their 2019 LTE only counterparts. We are playing a game with very little competition in the marketplace. It's very difficult to get my hands on MediaTek powered phones. The only MediaTek I've handled this year has been the LG Stylo with the P35. So we're talking a phone that easily sells retail and probably still makes a profit at $150. We need to examine how else we might be able to work in this industry. 5G solutions, powerful chipsets, Apple rolls their own silicon. Google might be working with Samsung to make their own chipsets. There's MediaTek. There's Samsung and the Exynos internationally. We're hoping that Samsung and AMD can do some interesting work together for a next generation Exynos platform. Kirin for only Huawei devices. But we haven't seen a solid direct confrontation against Qualcomm. Again, I would say sort of internationally, the best would be sort of a MediaTek in the mid-range, but nothing else. Nothing else that, you know, if you're an Android user, you can point to as like, well, if I don't want to spend this much money on a Snapdragon 865, I can get something that's a little less powerful, but is half the price. Doesn't really exist. I mean, you can import, but not really something sold here for North America. One of the things that's a little sticky about this rumor is the component pricing for the Snapdragon 865 is rumored to be somewhere around $160. But that doesn't that doesn't include the price of the modem. So that was one of my biggest frustrations with Qualcomm this year, was they removed the LTE modem from the chipset, requiring all manufacturers to buy a 5G capable modem just to use LTE. The 865, the actual CPU GPU chipset, rumored to be around $160. But I don't know what the rumored pricing is for the X55 modem. So when we see this pricing of, well, the 875 is going to be $100 more, it could be a $250 part, the rumor is indicating that that is including the separate modem. So it could be that a Snapdragon 865 costs $160 and the X55 modem costs $100. Like, this could be a lateral move if we never get details on what all of these individual components cost when they're purchased in large quantities. And Qualcomm can set rates. They can negotiate with individual corporations and phone manufacturers because they can. Where else are you going to go? Who else are you going to buy from? Ugh. So this is increasingly concerning. The reason why I want us to have this on the horizon. I don't feel Qualcomm gets the scrutiny that they really deserve. Everyone out there complaining about OnePlus jacking up prices, getting greedy. Not really. It seems to me that the major aspects of why a OnePlus 8 was more expensive at launch than a OnePlus 7T is because those component prices jumped, and then that caused extra licensing fees to verify 5G performance with carriers. That makes sense to me. So our ire shouldn't be with OnePlus making the best possible phone they can. Our concern should be carrier influence and Qualcomm having a near monopolistic stranglehold on the component market right now. So we should keep our eyes peeled and let's see if we ever get any good data on what goes into our phones, because it's getting pretty ugly out there. Kyle Ruggles, next on Netflix, The Qualcomm Cartel. Boing by, psst, hey kid, you want some Snapdragons? I got some good ones right here. It's just in my trench coat, just got to reach inside. And Root Knight 5, that's the curse of being the end point. Any price increase gets blamed on the last point in the chain. And these are the companies that build the relationship with consumers, right? If Samsung wasn't out there outspending Procter & Gamble for advertising, then Qualcomm wouldn't have the same relationship with consumers that they enjoy. You know, again, the parts that go into LGs, the parts that go into Motorola's, the parts that go into every other mobile electronics manufacturer, those companies are responsible for building the relationship with their consumers, and Qualcomm just gets to piggyback. So they know they get to hide behind those price increases so that those companies can still make a profit and that consumers aren't out there angry at Qualcomm. When, you know, 808s and 810s started boot looping, consumers were mad at the Nexus. Consumers were mad at LG. Consumers were mad at HTC. There was very little directional anger pointed at Qualcomm over the whole of the smartphone buying ecosystem. Kyle Ruggles, I'd love if AMD got into the smartphone game, they'd kill it. I completely agree. So we'll have to see. I think ARM is in good position to disrupt x86, AMD and Intel's main desktop and laptop business. I have to imagine that AMD and Intel are looking at alternatives to traditional chip fabrication for desktop and laptop computers. Especially now that Apple is making their own. And lastly, I have to bring this up because this makes me crazy sad. A number of outlets covered this, but I'm linking here to 9to5 Google. Alphabet reportedly buying North after minuscule Focal smart glasses sales. The Globe and Mail this evening reports that North is in the final stages of an acquisition from Alphabet, Google's parent company, is said to be paying $180 million for the Canadian company. This comes after North in December stopped selling Focals to focus on launching second-generation smart glasses sometime in 2020. Focals 2.0 have been teased over the past several months, with North claiming that they would be the most significant product introduction to date in the category. And I'm crazy sad that they are not going to be operating as a solo entity anymore. I am so frustrated with the current tone of tech commentary where it seems only the top winners in any industry get to decide for us what the future of innovation should look like. So many people sitting on their hands, seeing disruptive new technologies, but then going, yeah, but there was a one part of it that was kind of rough around the edges. So you should wait until like Gen 2 or Gen 3. And then we never improve. We never get real competition. We never have a disruptor enter this market because it seems like now the only viable business model is come up with an exciting product category, struggle to survive for a little while, and then hopefully get bought out. You know, from losing the Pebble as a smartwatch, which was well ahead of its time and still, I think, offers a better wrist-worn notification experience than anything else on the market, Apple Watch included. Watching that fall apart, get optioned by Fitbit, and then Fitbit getting bought up by Google, not a good track record. If we want good competition, if you like your Apple Watch and you want your Apple Watch to get better, you need other players in the market to spur Apple on to actually improve their product categories. I would say the update from Apple Watch 4 to Apple Watch 5 was pretty disappointing and didn't do much to really move the needle on wearable computing. If you can get your hands on a Series 4, in some respects, I think it's a better buy than the Apple Watch Series 5. So here we've got the Focals. And we've got a bunch of nerds, the tech enthusiasts out there, kind of writing off, yeah, I mean, sometimes the fit was a little uncomfortable and I was constantly shifting them around on my face so that it would line up with my eye properly. And like some valid concerns. I totally get it. But at some point, we also need to kind of put our money where our mouths are. We're going to talk about competition and new product categories and new methods of interacting with services and find something that will really move the needle on how we use this stuff. I'm tired of watching us all sit on the sidelines. And the Focals one, this one hit me really hard. I'm immunocompromised and my Focals are a godsend when I have to go outside. I don't have to touch my phone. I can keep a Ring controller under a glove if I need to wear gloves for some reason. They're a little hard to line up on my face when I kind of have to lock the ear hooks into place and then wear a mask. But they're so handy for almost every single interaction I'd want to have with my phone and keeping all of that information up in a heads-up display. So it's not enough to say, no, they're not good enough because they're a little bit heavy and, you know, they're just like, I feel like they could be better. Better than what? Show me what other heads-up display we have as a wearable face computer. Vuzix? That's an industrial-grade solution. Is there anyone else? And we're not talking Google Glass here. We're talking an extremely sophisticated notification, smartwatch-style, heads-up display system, which I can't wear all day, every day, but happily, immediately replaces a smartwatch when I'm out and about. The Apple Watch is great. It's the best smartwatch on the market today. Focals are better. They integrate into apps and services better. They interact with voice commands better. The UI is as fluid or more fluid. And they are so much more convenient than having something that I need to touch on my wrist, which is then another thing that I need to clean when I get back home. So I hope Google does this right. Google is sitting on their hands with Wear OS. Google has Fitbit. We haven't seen anything come from that acquisition. They're getting Focals for a pittance, considering how much R&D has gone into this type of heads-up display. What are they doing? What are they doing? I'm so tired of them buying up and then just kind of sitting on this tech because, well, I mean, profits are going to be more over here. So we don't want to disrupt Fossil from selling smartwatches. We'll just kind of shutter. We'll take all this IP and we'll eventually use it in a future product, but we're not going to do anything with it right now. We're well beyond needing these kinds of services, these types of accessories. It's just such a bummer. We got a couple comments here. From Ronald, I like Nexar. That's an Israeli company. I'll check them out. I didn't know that they had any consumer solutions, like something that could just be an easy pair of glasses. From JT Mote, I'm very interested in smart glasses, but I really don't want a pair I need to get fitted for. To be honest, the Google Glass approach was great. The issue was social stigma around the cameras. But you still had to have an adjustment to use Google Glass. I know someone else was mentioning that you can buy like used Google Glass on eBay, but I mean, again, this is something that like, if you properly convey this, you understand why. A wearable face computer is different than a generically accessible watch. Just like when you go and get glasses for vision correction, you need to manage your prescription so that it actually does the job it's trying to do. If you're putting something on your face, you are making a more biologically integrated access point for your technology. So you don't want that to be generically accessible. That will be a poorer experience. And that is one of the things that's really difficult about glass or focals or any of these types of solutions. Unless you make it a really ugly Borg implant thing that can be adjusted by the user, kind of like Vuzix, you see this big like swivel out thing that like plugs into your face. Not a convenient pair of glasses. You need to have some kind of adjusting process. You need to have some kind of face scan. And the dream is, now that they've gone through this, the second generation of the face scan got way more accessible. They could put up a little pop-up. They could go to stores that sell glasses, you know, prescription glasses or all kinds of places. You could set up an agreement to work with that. You could eventually get to a point where you just scan your phone with your face and they can kind of map everything that way. There are ways to improve on this, but you need the company to survive longer than Gen 1 to get there. And they were already iterating. What I did, I sat in a chair, boom, cameras kind of shot my face. They 3D modeled it. And a couple weeks later, I had a lens that was perfectly fitted to the distance of my face and eye so that I could see through it. So it's not as simple as just like, oh, I'm going to slap a watch on my wrist. It needs to be custom fit for me to have the best organic experience. And that's where I wanted to see that improvement. That's where I wanted to see them keep going. From Route 95, it sounds like people that don't wear glasses to me. They are a little fatiguing. I mean, let's be totally frank. There are batteries and there's a little mini projector. I mean, they're not light, but they also weren't crazy expensive. I mean, by the end of the run on Gen 1, I believe it was $600 for just a basic set of glasses and then $700 to use a prescription lens, which $700 for a nice pair of glasses isn't outrageous. Matt Tyler, as a person who wears glasses all the time, I would love to have glasses standard that had smart features with a heads-up display. And especially because you're already getting the glasses fit for you, incorporating those electronics would make a lot of sense. From ER1980, every time Google buys a company, Apple rubs their hands together with joy, knowing Google will potentially destroy one of their competitors. Oh, that's hilarious. The G in Google stands for graveyard, from Magus Ziad. Google seems like the John Cena of the tech industry startups. They bury everything, from Rue Sunshine. Oh, man. See, now, and if I had any faith in Google Punchkun, I would totally appreciate this. Google is buying all the wearables to eventually make an Iron Man suit. I would, you know, that would be awesome. I don't have any faith in Google doing that well right now. I want to see them iterate and improve. I want to see them make Wear OS more than just an also-ran smartwatch operating system. Wear OS should be an operating system you wear all over. It should be an operating system for headphones. It should be an operating system for glasses. It should be an operating system for cardiac tracking chest straps and sensors in your shoes and dynamic muscle activation and compression clothing. Wear OS, by its very naming, should be all of these things, and it is none of them. All right, so we're running a little long, and I don't want to push us to like 2.5 or 3 hours. How are we feeling about WWDC? Apple announced a whole bunch of stuff. It was a week ago, so I kind of feel like a lot of the sort of reaction conversation has already happened. We're a week out from the major keynote. There were still workshops and scheduled developer events that were happening online. And we got a lot of news. We got a lot of news about Apple's strategies for phones, for tablets, for the Mac, some major updates to the Mac, and some interesting stuff. If you were with us last week, I jumped immediately out of the podcast because I ran the podcast early to basically live tweet the WWDC keynote. And I was pretty snarky because I kind of feel like Apple still continues to get graded on a curve for a number of usability and user interface and compatibility issues that then when they fix those issues, they're just applauded and celebrated. But this whole time, their competition has already worked out some of those situations. So, I mean, like, it's low-hanging fruit. But, you know, this is Apple's site for iOS 14 as the preview. And the major announcements are some significant UI changes. So, you know, introducing widgets that can live on your home screen. And the app library, which is basically just an app drawer. So I made a video when the iPhone XS launched about 2 years ago, where I really struggled getting back into iOS because the UI for iOS hasn't changed significantly. Organization was a mess. I had to jump through hoops to organize folders. There weren't easy tools for alphabetizing your layout. And there was still enough functionality that depended on plugging an iPhone into another computer and going through iTunes to simplify and streamline some of the user interface. Now, I came out with that video. And I mean, a lot of people who follows my channel agreed with me. I mean, that's a given. But I also got a lot of pushback and a lot of, you know, bandwagon debate fallacy points, like Apple's the most profitable and millions of people use iPhones, so it must not be a problem. It can't be a problem because they're the most popular individual phone and everyone seems to use it just fine. So it's just you complaining about this. Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. And then 2 years later, iOS 14 is addressing most of the concerns that I had with iPhone UI. I'm looking forward to using iOS 14 because it reminds me of Windows Phone. This widget layout is basically cribbed from Microsoft. We want to talk about companies that had the right idea. They didn't stick with their communities. They didn't iterate and grow with their consumers. At one point, Windows Phone was starting to crack 10% of the smartphone market, especially throughout Europe. Live Tiles are still, I think, the best information delivery widget system we've ever seen on a phone. BlackBerry OS gave us better gesture support. Windows Phone, again, with dark themes and better support for OLEDs. All of these things that Google and Apple are trumping up now as improvements to their platforms are basically cribbed from WebOS, BlackBerry OS, and Windows Phone. They just had to give it a little time to incorporate poorer versions of those things that we used to love on those other platforms. And we're supposed to be happy about that. But it's not really competition. It's basically just Google and Apple kind of arriving at a midpoint where all phones are kind of the same. And that's such a depressing state for the mobile industry. But kind of jumping into this a little bit more, iOS 14 looks brand new, feels like home. Again, we've got all this feel-good messaging and marketing. Wow, just so amazing. It's so amazing, isn't it, folks? It's so amazing that we can now have widgets on the home screen. And you know what? They can be squares or they can be rectangles. That's amazing. Who would think that in the year 2020, we would finally be able to have a rectangular widget? Absolutely, just stunning. And now, because you've got widgets on your home screen, well, we should probably find a place for you to keep your apps. So app library, incredible. Just absolutely stunning. We can now organize apps and keep them tidied up. You don't have to page through to page after page after page of apps, as we've been complaining for years that the app layout on iOS is messy and takes a lot of user management to clean it up. I mean, I really do want to be happy about this stuff. iOS users, iPhone users out there, I really think you're going to like these features. But I also think you really would have enjoyed these features on Windows Phone back in the day. I think you would have enjoyed some of these features on Android if you'd really been able to give it a fair shake. Not through anyone's fault. Not like I said, switching ecosystems is not easy. But if you could separate the emotional attachment to one ecosystem and the incredible amount of lock-in that Apple has over their ecosystem, don't you think you would have enjoyed a lot of this other stuff on a premium Android phone too? There's no special Apple magic here. This isn't Apple redefining how we tuck apps away into different folders or we put a rectangular widget on a home screen. Apple's mission is like, well, they're going to give us the best polished version of this. Doubt it. I doubt it. Doubt. Windows Phone did this better. From everything that I've seen, I still haven't fired up an iOS 14 developer beta yet. But you know, I mean, like, they're getting really excited about picture in picture when the iPhone still can't properly multitask. The iPad can, the iPhone can't. But man, whew, picture in picture, like, why would you even need multitasking if all you do is watch Netflix and then look at your calendar? Boy, howdy, you're doing two things at the same time. But also, like, look at this calendar layout. Apple's design language is almost ripping off the Zune at this point. Just stark screens full of text where it's not always immediately clear what you're supposed to interact with or tap on. Where Microsoft is going to get all kinds of hate for poor conveyance, we're in the exact same boat with iOS apps at this point, where you're going to interact with different gestures from different corners of the screen with different pieces of text. And I really want that to be cleaned up more. I do like some of the changes to messages. I actually do like this cutesy stuff where as conversations are happening, you see different icons from people popping up and moving around. That kind of stuff is fun. It's really cute. Maps is getting some improvements. It's gotten a lot better. And I like this elevation stuff. But again, there's a part of me where I'm bouncing back and forth between Google Maps and Here Maps, and I think I'm good. What was the other one? Some of the translate features, better Siri integration. Siri has over 20 times more facts than just 3 years ago. Over 3 years, they added 20 times more facts. So if Siri had 100 facts, now they've got 20 times more facts. It's search. Siri is just plugged into Google search. What is this? Oh, Siri's memorizing facts. She's so clever. So, again, this is improvement. But we're not really living up to the Apple claims, the Apple marketing, the messaging that Apple's not going to be the first to the market with a new technology, but they're really going to refine it. We know Apple's going to give us the best consumer experience. No, we don't. I don't really feel that anymore. I have hope for it. I really want, as a former Apple acolyte and someone who used to be an Apple product specialist for Department of Energy facilities, that's what I want from Apple. But I don't really believe that's true. You know, slightly better notifications. I'm sorry, iOS notifications have a long ways to go to catch up to the simplicity and ease of use of Google notifications. The ability to define a couple default apps if you want to change a few features or a few settings. I want to be able to do that for everything. Music players, video players, calendars, email clients. I mean, like, I want everything to be user definable. And it's not enough for someone to say, well, but most Apple people don't want that. Well, according to most Apple people 2 years ago, they didn't want app drawers and they didn't care about widgets and they didn't care about less disruptive phone call splash screens and they didn't care about any of those things because Apple didn't give it to them. So because Apple didn't give it to them, they didn't care about it. And now Apple's giving it to them. So now suddenly they care about it. And that's backwards. We actually have been trying to motivate these types of positive change. From Fat Produce, did anyone see the rumors that Apple might not include the charger in the box for the next iPhone? I'm actually kind of positive on that idea. I feel like it would be okay to stop including that on all phones. There is a lot of e-waste that's generated by including lower spec charging bricks and cables that wear out easily and maybe a case that you're not going to use and some crappy earbuds that you really shouldn't put in your ears, especially if they're ear pods. All of that stuff kind of should end up in landfills the way that we're currently selling phones today. So there's a part of me that's kind of torn. Like, it's not going to make the phones cheaper. We know Apple's still going to be charging a premium, but it's going to be that one thing that they can kind of point to where, you know, component costs have gone up and the phones are getting more expensive, but we took everything out of the box, so the price tag looks the same. Mm-hmm. And again, I feel like they're going to put that out there. You know, it's going to be the iPhone 12 keynote. Oh, ooh, starting at $600 and everyone's going to lose their minds. And then it's going to be $30 for a charger and $15 for a lightning cable. And, you know, you're going to have to get some AirPods. So at least $150 just for Bluetooth, terrible earbuds and a case. And you're like, by the time you've outfitted that phone, it's going to be a $900 phone for their amazing prize. Amazing. So it's just, I don't know. Like I said, I'd like to see less disposable garbage going into the purchase price of a phone, but I'm not 100% on that being a better consumer solution. I'm just hoping it's better for the environment. And Fat Produce, I reuse the power bricks for all of my phone. I disagree. I don't think any phone should come without a charger. And totally fine. I totally get you. But I wonder, you know, like, again, I don't know what the consumer data looks like on accessories for who pulls a little mini iPhone charging brick out of the box and then goes and buys another better charger. I don't know. Apple's business model is kind of built on dongles and adapters and additional purchases and stuff like that. You know, if less stuff gets thrown away because of that, then I'm kind of for it. But again, that's also going to influence, well, then Samsung doesn't have to include a fast charger in the box. If someone's going to spend $30 for an Apple charger, they'll spend $29 on a Samsung charger, and they're going to learn the wrong lessons from what Apple is able to charge. Kyle Ruggles, you pay less for the movie, but you pay up the wazoo to get fed. Don't bring your own food. Moving right along. iPad OS also made a little extra noise during WWDC. I'm very positive on ARM computing and replacing laptops with phones and possibly with tablets. And I think iPad is probably the best argument in favor of that. So I watch this very closely because these are the types of apps and services that I hope will just migrate to other platforms like Android and Windows. Again, using Apple for a change as the proof of concept that people might enjoy this. Same thing, we're getting widgets. So that's cool. We're not getting, I don't believe we're getting the same app drawer experience, which is silly. Again, just because the iPad has a larger surface area display doesn't mean that you wouldn't benefit from a cleaner layout. More consistent app design would definitely be appreciated for iPad, sort of encouraging more app developers to follow this kind of panel view. And Apple finally getting all of their apps under a more unified UI would definitely be helpful. Same thing with compact calls, making taking up less space, and then better integration for stylus support. You know, so the Apple Pencil, it's pretty cool. I mean, a lot of this stuff I'm really happy to see because I want this on other platforms too. Especially using my Wacom pens on LG phones, kind of rekindled my love of having a stylus on a phone. So it would be nice if you could do that on an iPhone. I really don't feel like there's any reason why you couldn't. But Apple would prefer you own an iPhone and an iPad. So that's why. And then I like kind of the last, let me get this back over here. We're seeing the iPadification of macOS also. Big Sur is the update for macOS, doing it all in all new ways. Bold new experience, same Mac magic. So they're kind of ripping off Windows, like Windows Vista. If you remember Windows Longhorn, if you ever saw that back in the day, you know, refreshing a dock with a clock-based widget layout, that was kind of cribbed from Vista. Like, it didn't really work on Windows. It'll probably work better just because people will say it's good on the Mac where it wasn't good somewhere else. But more efficient Safari, customizable start pages, Safari extensions in the App Store. So extensions just like we use on Firefox and on Chrome, better translation capabilities, and better reporting for privacy, how Safari is watching other services track your behavior. Again, these are all really positive improvements and things that I think have been kind of neglected on Mac as a platform is catching it up to more modern and also sort of mixed computing. Again, we watched Microsoft beta test this in public, right? From Windows 8 to Windows 10 to these newest updates for Windows 10. Very different operating system environments. And I think Microsoft deserved a fair amount of criticism and joking at their expense for making that a very public beta test going from Windows 8 to Windows 10. But along the way, we also saw exactly how all of that went down. And macOS has just been, I think, in a more stagnant holding pattern with less functionality, less feature adds. Again, people are going to say, well, you don't need it on a Mac. Sorry, I love touchscreens on laptops. There's no reason why a MacBook shouldn't have a touchscreen. The reason is they want you to own an iPad. The reason isn't because it really doesn't contribute anything to the consumer experience. Touchscreens on laptops are cool. I like them. Oh, no, because Apple doesn't sell them, that means most people don't want them. So, but the reason why Big Sur is actually becoming such a big deal is, of course, because Apple's going to be rolling their own silicon. So there's going to be a new Apple chipset, a new Apple processor. They're going to be migrating away from Intel, like we talked about last week. And that's going to be a pretty seismic shift in the computer industry. Gives Apple better control over the hardware and software synergy, but it also likely could have an impact on consumer sales. Like, how do people shop for software that will run natively? They don't want to worry about emulated x86 software. They want it to run natively. And something tells me it's going to be a little bit more consumer lock-in on Apple's Mac app store, because apps are going to basically be coming from similar code bases. So should be easier to move back and forth between an iPad and a Mac OS device with the same software. But that means you're probably buying your software from that one singular point of Apple's store. And then also, I wonder what this will also mean for things like repairs, upgrades. A Mac Pro, will you be able to pop open the sockets and perform a CPU upgrade? What kind of GPU support are we going to see in these products? What kind of, for all this celebration of Apple as a content creation platform, I think it still leaves us with a lot of unknowns and also impacts. You know, Apple products retain their value pretty well. Next year, will people want to pay as high a price for a used MacBook, knowing that a sea change is right around the corner for, you know, dumping Intel processors and moving to Apple processors? I feel that will likely have an effect on things like aftermarket support, especially because Apple is aggressively positioned against right to repair protections for consumers. This is the kind of stuff that makes me really anxious. So what I get, like I said last week, this doesn't make me any more inclined to buy a new Mac with Apple Silicon, but it makes me really excited because hopefully that means we'll see more competition. You know, if Apple does this well, I have every expectation that they're going to do this well for the most part. But this puts way more pressure on Intel. Intel doesn't lose a ton of sales by losing the MacBook, but they lose some cachet, especially as they've been fighting a brutal battle against AMD. And AMD has to be looking at this move going like, man, they didn't go with us. Apple went and rolled their own. We've got to make sure that we can go toe-to-toe with Apple now in very similar product categories and very similar arenas. And it also hopefully lights a fire under Microsoft's butt that they're going to look at the continuity of Microsoft services and the flow with developer partners and with manufacturing partners and getting Dell and HP and Lenovo and Acer and Asus and Toshiba and Razer and Aorus and Gigabyte all on the same page to really iterate on next generation product categories. That's what I hope. The dream is Apple lights some fires by making this transition and it makes my products better. But I've got some serious concerns over people that are heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem when a company like this makes a change that's going to like further entrench the walled garden around their ecosystem. got a couple comments here from ER1988. You can't move the widgets on iPad OS and no app drawer either. I wonder if that's going to change though. Something tells me that they'll eventually offer widget organization, but something tells me that they'll also stick to their guns on iPads don't need app drawers because more screen, which is dumb. Kyle Ruggles, Longhorn. Root95, I miss Vista widgets so badly, but at the time they were crazy RAM hogs. Again, ahead of the curve. It wasn't a bad idea, but live tiles were better. I really wish I could still have kind of a live tile layout for like a second monitor in a way that's cleaner than kind of how Windows 10 handles the start drawer. Mm-hmm. Jim72165. All I could think about when they were talking about Safari is that safaris are for poachers. Just poaching those good ideas from Microsoft and Google and older companies that have fallen apart. Kyle Ruggles. Hello, computer. From Punch Coon, repair, upgrade, support, non-existent. I'd put money on it. So I do have concerns. Like, what is a MacBook with Apple Silicon look like for upgrading an SSD or popping in more RAM? I feel like those are some serious questions that we kind of need to tackle. And Fat Produce, Windows 10's desktop really feels stuck tied to the Windows XP days. It does. But again, when you look at like how this has changed, moved back and forth between Windows 8 to Windows 10, obviously you backtrack a lot, but you know, Windows Phone showed us how the Windows Start Bar becomes this sort of beautifully modular approach to navigating the content installed on your device. It is an app drawer and a widget notification system all in one. Immediate search, immediate organization, and little snippets of bite-sized data that are very easily accessible. And it's just a shame because if Windows Phone had continued, just imagine how refined and polished that would be today. Cortana was well ahead of the curve on context-sensitive voice commands. And Siri is still struggling to catch up with that kind of data integration. Google has been doing a little bit better, especially like, man, when you look at transcription, you know, pull up a Pixel 4 and put it up against an iPhone 11 Pro and talk at them, and you'll see savagely how much better Google can track speech, appropriately, you know, translate speech into text, and it's like instant, whereas an iPhone is just struggling to keep up. You know, those things matter. We want to act like software is this like free thing that comes on the hardware widget, but that kind of development ain't cheap and it's really hard to do well. But again, Apple will get credit when they catch up. The company who did it first never gets credit for really doing it well. So here's Google, you know, everyone slamming the Pixel 4. And I'm saying like, look at live caption. Live caption is actually a revolutionary feature for how we might interact with phones. It needs some more application, but the backbone of it is immediate. It can decode toddler speak in a video that I recorded and I'm streaming off of OneDrive. I mean, like, that's crazy. On device, no server side. And Apple will probably do it in 2022, and then everyone's going to be patting themselves on the back for Apple doing something great. And it will be great. And we'll have had it for several years on other competing platforms. WWDC, I really did. I mean, like, I was going through and I was really trying to calm down because I was getting very snarky with my live tweeting. And I was trying to find those moments where like, oh, well, some Apple Watch announcements sounded pretty cool. And I like some of the things that they're trying to make adjustments for there. But I just kept coming back to this feeling of like, Apple is such a successful marketing entity that it's incredibly difficult to generate a conversation around their products that isn't immensely emotional. Even for myself, you know, I kind of feel like Apple walked away from me. I kind of feel like Apple left me as a potential consumer and it disappoints me. So when I go and look at Apple products, there's that kind of specter. There's that emotional baggage over what I used to love about the company no longer really existing. And that's difficult. I mean, it's impossible. It's not difficult to separate yourself from that. It's impossible to separate yourself from that. And on the flip side, I'm watching people get really excited about this stuff who are heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem. And I'm really not. Rationally, I'm really not trying to rain on their parade. But again, I look at people who are sort of thought leaders in our industry of tech commentary grading Apple on this insane curve where they move the goalposts of their assessment based on when Apple delivers a new product, where I know for a fact that these features were just part of the Android UI, or, you know, people aren't really even using widgets that much anymore, or, oh man, look at who, when people customize their phone, it looks like garbage. Then celebrating Apple joining that same conversation. And I feel like that's part of the unfairness. That's part of the familiarity argument that I find most troubling in the current tech us versus them tribalism aspect of tech commentary. I bristle because we've had this amazing competition from different places. We've had groundbreaking design, really great options for hardware that Apple would never touch. But that's always dismissed. And it's always diminished. And then Apple will pick up a few of those ideas and celebrate it. And it's just so amazing. And Apple got there and Apple did it. And Apple doesn't need our help. Apple doesn't need that special consideration. They're Apple. They're the most profitable tech company on the planet. You know, they're making money hand over fist. They've got consumers locked in right where they want them. They can extract value from those additional purchases and accessory add-ons. Like, why? Why do we continue to operate as if like they're this plucky upstart? You know, it's like there's still that part of their DNA way back in history, in the fog of memory, where Apple was on the ropes and Microsoft invested money in Apple, and you know, they think different and they're disruptors. They're not disruptors. They're the market leader, especially in terms of profitability and extracting value per customer. No one's beating them. So why? I do not understand why. And I think that's what makes me so cranky whenever Apple comes up in a conversation like this. Vazicos 8, your live tweets were awesome. No regrets. Well, thank you. But again, I want to be careful because it's not the users. I'm not upset with people who own and like Apple products. I'm upset with mega corporations dictating how progress can happen and pushing out smaller players to make a less competitive landscape. And I'm very disappointed in tech commentators who kind of feed into this popularity argument because that's how we get paid. If my videos are more popular on YouTube, I get better ad revenue. If my videos are less popular on YouTube, I make less money. So it behooves me to have the kindest conversation pointing towards the largest potential audience. And I think that's a little gross. I think YouTube is responsible for kind of destroying how broad and how fair tech commentary used to be. I mean, it was never perfect, but everyone always has a bias and they always point their coverage in one direction or the other. But it didn't used to feel this divisively weaponized and this restricted to only allowing two or three players any type of conversation in the space. A lot of people talking about their first PCs. Oh, and yeah, Kyle Ruggles, I'll second this one. Responding to Alice Bockley, you will love Halt and Catch Fire. It'll bring back so many memories. It's like Mad Men for early computing. Halt and Catch Fire is such a good show. Lee Pace is awesome. What's her name? Mackenzie Davis or Mackenzie Phillips? I can't remember. She is just like emotional, weepy-eyed in the best possible way throughout so much of that series. Scoot McNairy. Oh, man. His character arc just breaks my heart. I've binged the show, I think, three times now from start to finish. And every time we kind of close in on the end of his story, I'm just sobbing. I'm just sobbing like a little baby. So it's Halt and Catch Fire. I can highly, wholeheartedly recommend. It's beautiful drama built around us older nerds who remember Tandy computers and Radio Shacks and other beautiful old text-based computing. So And lots of people talking about me being super super cranky. Let's go ahead and wrap this up. I want to say a huge thank you, especially for those of you in the live chat following through this conversation. I reorganized. I woke up early this morning because I knew I was in trouble, and I reorganized this list of articles 3 or 4 times, and still kept coming back to this is going to be kind of a heavy show. So I appreciate those of you joining these conversations because I still feel like these are very important stories to keep on our radars and to share this kind of information with family and friends, to at least put some of this data under their nose. If we're talking about legislation that might end privacy for online communications, if we're talking about social media services that are weaponizing our data or violating our privacy, even getting into the fun or the magic of a new product launch with shiny new glowing rectangles with new bobs and whistles and thingies. It means a lot to me to be able to kind of host a broad conversation like this, to dig through some of these darker topics, to have you all on board for sharing in some of this conversation, as it's not always the easier, the fun stuff to talk about, but it's still stuff that I think is important for us to keep bringing up. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your participation. And I, above all, appreciate your support. Those of you out there sharing and tweeting and joining chat rooms and live chat and posting on Reddit and upvoting stories from other people that are trying to make cool stuff. That's our future. Our future is engaged participation. Unless we want all of our control taken away from us and we only want to be told what we can and can't interact with, we need to get active. If you'll pardon one political plea, at the end of this, for the show notes, I'm going to have a link to the story for the Earn It Act, posted from the EFF. It's not enough for us to complain about bad legislation on social media. We're preaching to the choir there. I would humbly ask, I guess, whether you're for it or against it, that you, instead of posting a Facebook post, instead of starting a Twitter rant, take that energy, take that time, and take that effort to write an email to your senator and to your House of Representatives, your congressional member. I mean, again, you might be for ending encryption, which in this audience, I'm not sure who would be. But I'm going to humbly ask that instead of taking this information and shouting into the ether of Facebook or the void of Twitter, send it directly to the offices of people who are responsible for writing and employing this kind of legislation. I feel like moving forward, beyond just supporting your content creators, we tech geeks can't be above politics. Oh, it's so unseemly and dirty, and I'm just above it. Our entire industry, our hobby, our lifestyle, this technology that we love and enjoy, it's all politics. It's all money. It's all influence. And it's about time I think we started exercising our influence directly, participating directly. And especially knowing the people that I've got listening to this and those that disagree with me, I know that I'm speaking to people who are thoughtful and consider their positions. You don't disagree with me just because you hate my face. I mean, maybe part of that too. But you disagree with me because you've thought through these and you've come to different conclusions than me. That I'm for. I'm for that engaged debate. and I hope to foster more of that in the coming weeks and months. When it comes to the Earn It Act, just like it came with net neutrality, just like it came with the Broadband Choice Act of the early 2000s, I'm a little worried about this one. This one's concerning to me. So I hope you'll take the time to contribute directly to that conversation. Folks, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to be awesome with your technology. I want you to do awesome with your technology. Thank you so much for joining me on this conversation. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDG QA podcast channel. Stay safe out there. Times are still pretty crazy. I want to see these names coming back next week. I want you all well. I hope you stay healthy. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.